Yeah, you're Steve Fuller, August Kant Professor of Sociology, mm-hmm. of Social Epistemology at Warwick University. And my first very general question would be, how do you get to be where you are today?
How do you want me to address this exactly in terms
of... Starting with your childhood.
Well, you know, I did, for the 50th anniversary of Warwick University, which was last year, I actually did 6 hours of interviews about...
Oh, God.
Yeah, for their archives, right? Yeah. You know, so-called distinguished professors, and so they have these archives now. Well, look, why don't I start by saying some general things, and then you can maybe ask some follow-up questions if you find certain things interesting. So, first thing to say, I guess, would be in terms of my background, I'm what would be called a sort of pure scholarship student. In other words, I come from a poor background, but in terms of going through the educational system, I was someone who always took exams and got into the best schools on the basis of it. And so I went to a Jesuit preparatory school before going to university. And I won an early admission scholarship to Columbia University, and then I got a fellowship to come to Cambridge, where I did my master's degree. And then I got a Mellon pre-doctoral fellowship, which paid for my way at the University of Pittsburgh, where I did the PhD in history and philosophy of science. And that was the best place, that is the best place to do it, I think, in the United States. And so that was kind of like my intellectual background. And so from a fairly early age, I thought of myself as wanting to go into an academic career. And the key thing about it, I guess... And this comes from my training with the Jesuits, was I actually think about kind of that academia is kind of the place where you sort of develop human capital in people. So if you really want to have an impact on the next generation, and you really want to have some sense of long-term power, that education is the place to be. And... And I was always very convinced of that. So in this respect, my interest in going to academia was never purely a matter of just reflective scholarship or anything like that. Mm. You know, like, I'm interested in this stuff, and so I'd like to spend the rest of my life doing it. That wasn't really where I was coming from. I've always been coming from it to it from a more power-oriented political angle, even. And I've always had a very very long-standing interest in politics, and still do, and so I so that's kind of my orientation coming into this business, and this is why it was very easy for me to kind of see the idea that if we're going to talk about knowledge as having some kind of validity, right, there's got to be something behind it backing it up. It's got to have something that's kind of, as it were, forcing it on the public mind. And so this is where kind of the sociological angle comes in, right? Because it isn't just purely about the ideas. Because very often ideas are around for, you know, a long period of time. And people treat them basically as fictions. They don't treat them as something that's actionable. And so then the interesting question is, you know, under what circumstances do people feel compelled or feel motivated to actually act in a collective manner on behalf of certain ideas that would then lead them to be institutionalized, you know, and carry on for a long period of time beyond the lifetimes of the people who initially start them. And so this is kind of social epistemology, in a sense, kind of comes into view, right, under those circumstances. Now, the time at which I... And by the way, you know, the name of my professorship, you mentioned it, Auguste Comte, right? Comte is a guy who I ran across very early on as a kid, okay? Because one of the things that I did when I was a teenager, when I was in this Jesuit school in New York, was to read about the biographies of the philosophers, and Comte has a very kind of colorful life in a way, at least for a philosopher. And I was really very much struck by this kind of progressive vision and all this kind of thing going on. And when I was growing up in the late 1970s, right, which is in a sense kind of the peak of the Cold War, a very common way of thinking about the state of the world, which I think is completely absent now because of the postmodern condition, but I still remember when things weren't postmodern, that there were basically competing progressive agendas, you might say, You know, the U.S. and the USSR, right? Capitalism and communism, right? Or socialism or whatever, right? Both of which, in a sense, had very progressive visions, and in a sense, very often drawing on this, well, drawing on the same past, but projecting different futures from it. And that's kind of what, I'm still very much animated by that, okay? Mm-hmm. Then that's one of the things that, in fact, comes to be debunked and deconstructed during the postmodern era, and of course, with the end of the Cold War, and especially the fall of the Soviet Union, right, then the whole political point of this kind of way of thinking of things starts to get called into question, and you probably recall Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History and the Last Man, that in a sense, you know, now all of that, of course, changed with 9/11 and so forth, but what it didn't bring back was this idea of a progressive trajectory or anything. Right now it's just like chaos and disorganization and, you know, skepticism all over the place about any kind of big institutional structures that can sort of channel human ambition or human ideas or anything like that. Well, I'm still very much of the old school in this respect, okay? And I'm trying to, in a way, reinvent, rediscover, revive a lot of that kind of older progressive sensibility. That's kind of where I'm coming from. Now, the thing that kind of complicates the story, you know, especially people who kind of know something about me from the writing side, is I enter into this as a, you know, as an academic, a young academic, during the period when science and technology studies is coming on the scene. And I would say, I still would say this, that in a sense, it was very much, and I have always acknowledged it as my, it's kind of the postmodern moment coming into our understanding of science and knowledge production more generally. Now, in the early 80s, when I started getting on top of this, so I read Lyotard's The Postmodern Condition, you know, when it first came out into English in 1983 as a graduate student, and I was very much taken by it. But there's always a question, right? Because, I mean, people often forget this, but Lyotard was basically writing what was called a report on the state of knowledge, right, for the Higher Education Council of Quebec. And so, you know, it was kind of ambiguous reading that book, whether he thought this was good, you know, or was it bad, or is he just laying out the facts? And my view is that he was just laying out the facts, in a sense. That in a sense, he was drawing our attention to things about the way in which knowledge had been developing, especially over the course of the 20th century, that did not conform to these kind of neat progressive trajectories of universal knowledge and all this kind of Habermas nonsense, right? That was very much part of the way, you know, at university, people were very keen on Habermas. But already by the early 1980s, people were beginning to see this was getting a bit threadbare. It doesn't really capture the way things are. But the way, and science and technology studies in a way adopts kind of this perspective, but in a more intensive kind of way. So it's not just simply surveying the fact that, you know, the forms of knowledge that have had the most impact in the 20th century have often originated outside of universities, have often not conformed to disciplinary boundaries or normal kind of norms of scientific knowledge production. They've involved business and the military and all kinds of other things. You know, but getting what science and technology studies does in addition to all that, mentioning, is to get into the what it's like on the ground, right? And so you get a much more micro sociological analysis. And what you find there is that the activities and the language that people use are much more, you might say, ordinary, much more like that of ordinary social life, and do not actually, you don't see much sign of the supposedly special epistemological status that science is supposed to have. You really just don't see that. In fact, just using fairly ordinary sociological categories can pretty much capture everything you observe. And this is a big deal, right? It's a very demystifying move, right? What is it demystifying? Well, it's demystifying people who come in with whatever, you know, scientific realist or logical positivist, kind of, you know, the kind of classical normative philosophical perspectives on science, which start with the assumption that science is different, and now we have to just figure out what makes it different. And even Robert Merton, with those four norms of science, same deal, right? And it is really striking when one looks at how Robert Merton did this kind of his sociology of science. It was largely by quoting what scientists and philosophers said about science. It wasn't actually looking at what they were doing. So this is a big deal, okay? So this is a big shift, and, you know, Latour and Woolgar and Carrington or Satina and all these people in the early period are really very important. And as a graduate student, you know, reading this stuff, and it wasn't really being taught in our graduate seminars, I have to say. That's a point I think it's worth pointing at. I mean, it was mentioned, so you kind of knew it was there somewhere. And I went to some of the professional meetings of philosophy of science early on, and when I was a graduate student, I did hear and I saw some of these people speak and so forth. But it wasn't really part of the mainstream curriculum at all. But I knew there was something there. And in fact, some of my early writings actually tried to bring some of this stuff into more mainstream philosophy of science journals when I was a graduate student. But my view about all this all along, and this is true even today, was that at the end of the day, science and technology studies should not be seen as kind of a thing unto itself. It shouldn't be seen as just a field that is like a new discipline or a new interdiscipline that arises, but rather as a kind of corrective so that we can actually have more realistic normative approaches to knowledge production.
That would be your take on SES.
Yes, that's right. And so what I did not expect, which has happened, I think, is that science and technology studies have become kind of an autonomous field where people just spend all their time, you know, demystifying, deconstructing, you know, and that's kind of an end in itself. Okay, and what it looks like is, you know, very often the kind of demystifying ethnographies and things that you're familiar with from other fields and so forth, and it's kind of in a weird, you know, it's a combination of demystification and sometimes a weird exoticization of other things, you know, so you end up getting a very unfamiliar look at something that you thought you already knew, which is a very common kind of ethnographic trope. But I always thought about this not as an end in itself, but as a corrective that then would get us to rethink what the norms ought to be. And this is kind of where I've always been at, right? So in this respect, I've been a bit disappointed by the way, I mean, it seems to me the field, even though the field has grown in the sense of numbers of people practicing it, I think it's kind of intellectually stagnated, okay? In the sense that I don't see it as really doing anything. You know, the conceptual resources for doing science and technology studies have not changed very much since the time I was a graduate student, I don't think. Mm. I think it's just got more people doing it, got more case studies, you've got more... But I don't think the basic ideas have changed very much. Mm-hmm. And you see, and that I think is very striking. It's often the sign that something's becoming a discipline, that it kind of settles down, you know, yeah. And it isn't just turning out ideas all the time. But I think it's very disappointing, because I always have had a very kind of holistic view of how one should be studying knowledge. And so history, philosophy, sociology, all these other disciplines ought to be playing equal roles in this. And what I was always very much against was the idea of a kind of, you know, segregation of mm-hmm. these disciplines going in their, you know, own course. But I'm afraid that's kind of what has happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's kind of... So the point, but in terms of my own, you know, in terms of my own trajectory, if you look at my work, I have been very much concerned, with the big normative questions, but always thinking in terms of what the vehicles are, you know, and so, you know, one thing that becomes increasingly prominent in my work, and it's the subject of the last book, this book, I have a book coming out at the end of this month, it's called The Academic Caesar.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that one.
Yeah. Well, it's about the university, obviously, right? And the thing is, I have become increasingly interested in the university as a vehicle for knowledge production because it is the only dedicated institution to produce knowledge as a public good. And, you know, so often we take for granted that knowledge is a public good, but knowledge just isn't automatically a public good. Knowledge, in some sense, has to be made a public good. Mm-hmm. So where does that making happen? And this is where you need institutions like the university, you know, which have the kind of collective memory and the reproductive processes, and you think about how the institution is organized with regard to knowledge production, and you realize you need something like that, because otherwise what happens is knowledge would just become pure property and it would be, you know, the people who can afford it can get it and the rest don't and all the rest of it. So this has kind of been where my thinking, you know, has been moving, and it's also moved in other directions with regard to the future of the human beings, and maybe we can talk about that. Mm-hmm. But in each case, what I'm concerned about is kind of how do you embody or institutionalize a certain kind of normative idea that you're trying to promote, you know, that we associate with knowledge or the human or something like that. And that's been very much a constant focus of my work. And it's always been there. It's always been there from the very beginning.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been there from the very beginning. And it's just that, you know, as the, you know, times change, you know, because I'm not a very much a, you might say, I'm a bit like this. Here's a way of thinking about someone like me. There are two kinds of Christians in this world. There's a kind of person who is a Christian but is really a church member, right? And so the only Christians that they recognize are the ones who are members of their church. So they won't call Catholics Christian, for example. Mm-hmm. Certain kind of Protestants do this. But then there's another kind of Christian who, in a sense, is kind of a Christian and maybe kind of without church, you know, or doesn't feel like he has to go to church on Sunday or, mm-hmm. you know, and kind of moves around, you know, but feel still, I'm more in that category, that latter category. So I don't feel a particular need to conform or identify with this discipline or that discipline. So like, you know, here I am in sociology department. I never worked in a sociology department until I moved to this country over 20 years ago. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so...
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, one of the things that happened when I moved from the United States to Britain was I suddenly became a sociologist. Of course, I know about sociology. I know sociology. I've studied it. It's not a problem. But I didn't see that as a big deal. Because I do get people asking me, wow, is it strange being in a sociology department? You know, you're really a philosopher, blah, blah, you know. And that doesn't, I don't think twice. I mean, the thing about sociology in this country, as opposed to the United States, is that sociology in this country is less professionalized, basically, right? So a lot more is allowed.
Do you think that's a good thing?
Or? Well, I think it's good for me. I mean, that's my point, right? The point is...
I read your tweet from last week where you said you're looking forward to the complete professionalization of academia.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is... No, because here's the thing. I mean, I think when we talk about disciplines as the vehicle for professionalization, this is where the problems start, okay? Because the disciplines then force you to think about things in a certain kind of way. And if you want to think about something that's not in your discipline proper, in order to think about it legitimately, you have to somehow bring it into your discipline. And so that often means you have to distort it and make it more difficult. And whereas it makes a lot more sense to me to just say, well, don't treat the disciplines that seriously. Just go where the ideas are. I mean, that's putting it a little crudely, but I do think that there's a sense in which what academics should have is a kind of sense of intellectual autonomy, right? Where in a sense, you know, you're thinking about something, you're doing a project on something, right? It's about this, and then you use whatever ideas are appropriate to forward what you're trying to do. And that you shouldn't worry so much about whether most of the ideas are coming from the discipline you're part of or not. Okay? See, I think one of the reasons why it gets to be so difficult to talk across disciplines is because the imperative to keep to the discipline is so strong that you can't really acknowledge you can't acknowledge ideas from the other discipline in their own name. So you have to reinvent them in your discipline. And this is really true in the social sciences, where there's a lot of the similar ideas, right, that are cross-discipline but named quite differently. And unless you've really mastered mastered the jargon and mastered the kind of the canon of these fields, you don't quite realize these guys are talking about the same thing when it gets down to it, right? It takes a lot of effort to do that. And I think that this is part of the way in which disciplines end up legitimating themselves and keeping their people inside. But I just don't see the intellectual advantage of that. I mean, I think it's what is the reification of bureaucracy, right? Because obviously, in some sense, you need to group people together and you need to organize them. You know, you think about universities, departments, things like that, of course. But the idea of thinking that they correspond to realms of reality, like there's the economic realm and there's the political realm and there's the social, you know, I mean, that's not really the case, you know? And if you go far back, and see, this is where knowing something about the history of disciplines is useful, because you go far enough back, you realize that these disciplines were all one discipline at some point, you know, and moreover, the way in which they've divided up varies significantly according to country. That's another thing, too, right? You know, so like the development of sociology in Britain is radically different from the United States, where there's a lot more early professionalization going on in the United States, okay? So you know, these kinds of things, when you have this in your mind, and you know, social epistemology already is talking about a lot of this stuff, about the disciplinary boundaries and everything, you know, you start to take it to heart, right? It's not just a fact of history, but it has a kind of reflexive implication with regard to how you think about the way the academy is organized today. You see, and so that's kind of where I'm coming from, and it's one of the things that makes me kind of a, you know, people think, you know, sort of what, maverick, rogue, Scott, whatever, because in a sense, I think a lot of these things that people get very excited about with regard to disciplinary affiliation and so forth, I think are vastly overrated and a diversion from what we should be concerned about.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, I'm sorry, I've been going on for a long time.
That was great.
Yeah.
Maybe just a few follow-up questions.
Sure.
In the 80s, around 83, 84, I guess you got in touch with all this STS
stuff. That's right, that's right.
Were there any teachers or professors at the university that taught that kind of stuff? You said it wasn't really around.
Well, okay, so I'll tell you what was taught, okay, because it wasn't completely... So when I was at Cambridge, right, so Cambridge, I'm in Cambridge from 79 to 81. Mary Hesse. Okay, philosopher of science, who was actually the person who brought Habermas to Cambridge to give a talk a few years earlier. She was the one who introduced me to David Bloor, Knowledge and Social Imagery, and the whole Edinburgh School thing. Because, see, those guys, who don't get talked about very much anymore, but those guys, the interesting thing about them was that they were very directly engaged with the philosophers, right? In a sense, you know, and so they were explicitly relativistic, right? They, in other words, they took opposing views very direct. You know, they were signaling to the philosophers, we are opposing you. We're not just doing something different. We're actually challenging you. And I came into science and technology studies kind of with that frame of mind too, though I didn't necessarily buy the content of what Bloor and Barnes and people like that were doing. But I thought, yes, this is kind of, in a sense, what Barnes and Bloor and all these Edinburgh guys were doing was a kind of philosophy. It was a sociologically informed philosophy that was challenging a lot of the taken-for-granted views. And in a sense, it was seen as very much continuous with what, you know, in the 1960s and 70s had been the historical turn in the philosophy of science, right? You know, from the post-Popperians, you know, Lakatos, Feyerabend, Kuhn, people like that, you know, Hansen, Toulmin. Those guys already had made a kind of explicit challenge to a kind of, you know, logically based normative philosophy of science. And now these sociological guys are coming on board and doing kind of the same thing, but pushing it even further. Right? And people like Barnes and Bloor quite explicitly drew on guys like Kuhn. Right, I mean, so there was a kind of, you know, self-understood continuity, and that's kind of how I got into science and technology studies, and that was the sense in which it was being taught. So when I went to Pittsburgh, Barnes and Bloor were taught there, but not Latour, Woolgar, Corsatina, not the ethnographic stuff, but this stuff that was kind of more theoretical and much more at the conceptual level, you know, and dealt with relativism and realism and, you know, these kind of very familiar philosophical topics, rationality, whether it's a universal rationality to science, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that was kind of how... So I got into it that way, but it was only going to the professional meetings of the Society for Social Studies of Science, which is like the 1983-84 thing you're referring to, that I began to see pretty clearly kind of this other side, which became the dominant side of science and technology studies, which was much more ethnographic, you know, not overly concerned with dealing with the normative questions at all, but kind of just trying to figure out what's going on the ground and so forth, and quite happy to be a kind of, generally speaking, demystifying, defamiliarizing force without necessarily advancing a particular positive ideology of science, right? So they weren't Marxists, right? This is a very interesting... No, and that was kind of an important thing, of course, because... you know, alongside of all this, there was still this kind of Marxist tradition, you know, critical of science, and you know, there and it ran alongside this, and people did know about it. I mean, I one person kind of on the soft end of this that was talked about a bit back then was Jerome Ravitz. I don't know if you've heard of him.
No, I don't.
Okay, it's a book called... Yeah, it's called Science and Its Social Problems. It was published in 1971 or two. Mm-hmm. And this book was really, it was a good book, actually. He was a student of Stephen Toulmin's, and it was a book that got publicity at its time, because what it did was it kind of, again, I don't know if you recall this, but back in the 70s, right, there was this kind of... there were two kinds of Marxism floating around, basically. One aspect of Marxism was a kind of very heavy structuralist kind of Marxism, which was very much about modes of production. You know, Althusser, of course, in the mainstream Marxism. But it also carried over a lot of this kind of older kind of Marxist sense of history of science that was a kind of technological determinism in a way. It was kind of like that.
Aronovitz?
So he would be a more recent version of that, but kind of in that vein, yeah. But the person back, you know, the real guy behind this in an English speaking world was J.D. Burnell. I don't know if you're familiar. Burnell was a physical chemist who wrote this 4-volume history of science and so forth, and he had this incredible... He believed that the scientists ought to unite as a kind of, you know, kind of do what the proletariat failed to do, in terms of providing this kind of universal consciousness to be the vanguard of society. Yeah. So this is kind of heavy Marxism kind of floating around. You know, and they were the kind of guys who were saying, you know, Newton was kind of an expression of bourgeois capitalism as it was emerging in Britain, you know, this kind of stuff. But then there was this other kind of Marxism, and this is where Ravitz comes in. And it was this so-called praxis Marxism, okay? And this is like humanistic Marx, and this was kind of the result of... a lot of early Marx's works being translated into English in the 1960s. And the Frankfurt School was very big on this version of Marx. Of course, they had read it in German. But finally, English speakers were able to, you know, figure out what they were talking about, because you get this kind of softer image of Marx where it's about the craft, right? And the idea of being able to own your own labor and speak on its behalf and all this kind of stuff. And this guy Ravitz was very much into that. Okay, and in fact, he was one of the first people to flag issues like intellectual property. Mm-hmm. You know, that this was going to become a problem for scientists. The scientists were basically going to lose control altogether. They're going to be completely alienated from what they do. And also the research ethics stuff. He was the first guy to really articulate these notions back in the early 1970s. And he was talking about a move toward critical science. And it was aligned also with the environmental movement because, you know, again, I don't know if you recall, there was this guy in the United States who was a very big ecologist who was very active politically, a guy named Barry Commoner. Yeah, he's another guy who Ravitz was citing. And so if you're back there in the early 1970s, right, where you're critiquing the military-industrial complex, right, scientists being alienated from their labor, then you have this ecological concern going on, that's all in that book. It's all in that book.
Okay.
Yeah, but it went nowhere. I mean, this is the point. It had a kind of initial blast, and people kind of knew about it, but the interesting thing is no one ever followed up on it. Now, Ravitz moved from America to Britain, and he's still alive, and he still writes stuff.
Oh.
But he's a pretty minor fringe guy, though people who are in the kind of more critical science policy areas do know about him.
I should know about him.
Yeah, yeah, but he was, and one of the things that I would say about the attitude of, so the question then becomes, okay, so there was this guy there who was kind of an interesting guy. I've had him write endorsements for some of my books. I have a lot of respect for the guy, actually. But no influence. And in fact, when this book, Science and Social Problems, was republished for its 25th or 30th anniversary or something like that, it was reviewed in the journal Social Studies of Science by Steve Shapin.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know him.
Yep.
Okay? Shapin just tore it apart. Shapin thought, these 60s nostalgia, flower power. He basically thought the book was flaky. He made it look like it was something out of San Francisco in 1968. You know? Whereas it's a very serious book. But the point was, the science technology studies never went down this route. Right? It never went down this route. It didn't become critical social science. It didn't become any of that stuff. Even though there was the possibility there.
Yeah.
And in fact, it didn't even go down the route of Barnes and Bloor, which would have made it a critical force within philosophy. But instead, it went down this other route, which was, you know, very ethnographically driven. And the reason why I think this has happened is largely a political economy thing. In other words, that's where the money is. Mm. You know, science technology studies, even to this day, despite the fact that it's been around for 40 years, is not well institutionalized as an academic discipline. However, there are a lot of people who practice it in many different places across the university. And why is that? Well, they can get grants.
Hmm.
There's lots of grants to be gotten doing this kind of work at all kinds of levels. Public funders, private funders, everywhere. So there's money to be had doing it this way, especially if you don't come in with a heavy conceptual or theoretical agenda. Right? Because then, you know, it's always hard for Marxists to get grants because Marxists are going to end up saying someone's exploiting somebody. And that's often the funder doesn't want to hear that, right? But with your science and technology studies, you operate, over this thing, you know, which Bloor originally called and Latour, you know, just went to town with, the symmetry principle. Yeah, exactly. The symmetry principle, that's the get-out clause for everything, right? Everything's treated equally. We don't make judgments about true or false. Everything, hey, it's all there. Yeah, you see? And that's a grant winner. And so if you look, you know, if I had to say what was so successful about Latour, you know, over somebody like Bloor, right, because there was this brief period, I would say, in the 1980s, late 80s, early 90s, when Bloor and Latour were seen as somehow battling each other, but Latour clearly won, and I think a very key part was that the way Latour always presented what he was doing was not as a theory, was not as an argument, but as a method. Okay? And that was the thing. Because then you don't need to get into these sophisticated discussions with philosophers and things like this. You don't need to, you know, do all these dialectics and things, right? But rather, all you need to do is you have like a toolkit, right? This is what Latour is all about. It's a toolkit where you have certain sensitizing devices, lets you see things, opens things, open the black box, right? All the rest of it, follow the actors. You got all these little tips, and then you can do research, and he's got a cute kind of labeling scheme where you could stick labels on stuff. You can call things assemblages, you know? I mean, you don't need these words. We've got perfectly good English words for talking about what he's talking about, but now you can kind of make them look fancy a little bit, right? And so this sells. This was the trick. I mean, and it worked. And what it allowed, I would say this, it allowed people from many different backgrounds to enter into science and technology studies because you no longer needed to be a philosophical sophisticate, right? Because the thing about science and technology studies in the very early days with Barnes and Bloor and all those other guys was they were having arguments with philosophers. And if you didn't know the difference between realism and relativism and you weren't quite sure, you know, you were not going to really go very far. But with Latour, you don't need to know anything. In fact, knowing less helps. You know, and then you just bring in the bag of tricks, and you you come, and you suddenly, you know, reveal all these things. But for me, most of these case studies that we see in science and technology studies today are interesting because of the content. In other words, if you're studying something interesting like xenotransplantation or something like that, that's going to be interesting regardless of what language you're talking about it in. That's just interesting stuff, right? And science and technology studies does have a knack for studying kind of cutting-edge, interesting kind of things. But anyone could do that. I don't see science and technology studies itself as providing any kind of conceptual added value. Mm. It's just, as it were, they just have a good, you know, they just know where the action is. But what they say about it, no, I mean, because this is the thing. I mean, I often find when I read the stuff that the best articles are the ones where they actually give you a good sense of what these guys are doing. But when you get to the part of the paper which is about their own analysis from a science and technology study standpoint, there's nothing going on there. I mean, all they're doing is showing how it's similar to other works in the field and all the rest of it. But that's pretty uninteresting, mm-hmm. you see. So I think in this respect, you know, the field's really lost. Even though the field has grown and it's become more prominent in a certain way, I think it's kind of really lost a lot. It's kind of lost a lot of its own content over the years, you know. So I always have very mixed feelings about it, you know. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Latour as a person. He and I debated last year in California.
Okay.
Because we were talking about whether there's such a thing as a good Anthropocene.
Oh, yeah, he's still onto that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like he's a bad Anthropocene guy, mm. and I'm into a good Anthropocene. So we had a little debate about this in California. Mm. And, you know, he's fine. He's a very intelligent man and all the rest of it. But it's his followers, man. I mean, those guys.
Yeah.
Those guys, oh! but see, this is something I did not anticipate, you know, when I started getting interested in science and technology studies 30 years ago. I did not anticipate it was going to turn out like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wrote some stuff on Latour. I'd be really interested to hear what you think about that.
Yeah.
Okay. That's really great. I don't think I have any more questions about the biographical part.
Okay.
We don't have much time left, so if it's okay,
go ahead, keep on going.
To talk about your first book, Social Epistemology. And in the book, I think it lays the groundwork for most of what follows in your career. It's a normative approach to epistemology, it's a normative approach to social epistemology. Yeah. And in it, you critique both contemporary epistemology and the sociology of knowledge and, by proxy, STS.
Yes. What was STS back then, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And my first question would be who your intended audience was for this, because it is a...
Yeah,
it
good
is
point.
Not a very disciplinary thing.
Well, it's an interesting point. The series it was published in with Indiana University Press was one that was on science, technology, and society. It was the first one. It may have been the first series of that kind. And so it was edited by Thomas Guerin. I don't know if that name means anything to you.
No.
He's kind of interesting in the history of STS because he was Robert Merton's research assistant. But then when he left Merton, got his PhD, he very quickly moved into the STS camp. Mm. So he was a very important kind of transitional figure. It got the book, I mean, if you're looking at how it got taken up, it was picked up initially more by philosophers than sociologists. And it's only since I've moved to this country that I've really got a lot of sociologists paying attention to me.
Hmm.
Okay, now I think the thing that's worth saying about the timing of social epistemology is that, you know, nowadays if you think about social epistemology and how that phrase is used and who's doing it and all the rest of it, as you probably know, there are enormous numbers of analytic philosophers who are doing a kind of social epistemology, and those guys were around back then too, but now there's just a lot more of them around. And so it might seem strange for me to tell you that the book, my book, was actually read more by philosophers and sociologists. But that was because there weren't so many of those analytic guys around. Okay, so actually, some of those analytic people actually were reading my book.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because you got to keep in mind that somebody, you know, so we think about guys like Alvin Goldman, for example, as an analytic social epistemologist. His main, though he had been writing about it throughout this whole period, his main statement only comes out in 1999, right? And somebody like Philip Kitcher, another analytic philosopher who wrote, you know, 1993, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so until these people start charting out a very clear kind of analytic version of social epistemology, people were kind of, you know, the analytic guys were reading my book. In fact, I did get invited to speak at departments in the United States which were analytic philosophy mm-hmm. departments. I was received with mixed reception. I'm not saying everybody loved what I was saying, but that was kind of the case. In fact, I think it's worth pointing out that when I was my first job out of graduate school, which was at the University of Colorado, I was hired as an analytic philosopher. Right?
Yeah,
I was hired as an analytic philosopher. And the thing was, because I got my PhD at University of Pittsburgh, I think that kind of, that pedigree, before people actually know much about your actual writing, and, you know, but they're kind of going on what they know from your educational background and so forth, I actually have a, you know, respectable analytic mm-hmm. philosophical background. I mean, insofar, you know, if I have to say, you know, what's my professional training in philosophy, it is analytic philosophy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I was at Cambridge, I was writing papers on philosophy of language and philosophical logic and all that other stuff. And, you know, I mean, so while I did, as a graduate student, publish papers in continental philosophy a bit, that was kind of almost like a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't what I was trained in.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I do have kind of intellectual affinities with some of that stuff, that wasn't what I was trained in. So that was the thing. The philosopher, and also back at that time too, I think the philosophers were a little bit more open-minded to STS also, I think, in the sense that, you know, given that they had just gone through this whole historicist phase,
mm.
you know, they'd spent the last 10, 15 years getting used to Kuhn, right? We got used to Kuhn, now we can put up with these guys.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was some of that. You know, like okay. You think about, I'll give you an example. A guy who I knew who was very much like this was Larry Loudon. I don't know if that name means anything to you, Loudon.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about him.
Yeah, it's
the first thing I marked here.
yeah, Larry Loudon. You know, so he was a transitional guy too, right? He was one of the younger historicist people,
mm-hmm.
right? So guys like Kuhn and Toulmin and Hansen, Feyerabend, Lakatos, they were all born in the early 1920s, all those guys. When you talk about Loudon, you're talking about somebody born in the 1940s, early 40s. And so he was kind of like the cutting edge of that whole historicist thing. And he was the first guy, in fact, when I went to the University of Pittsburgh for my PhD, he was the guy I wanted to study with, but he left by then. He went to Virginia Tech, and then another several years later, I replaced him. Because I taught at Virginia Tech, I replaced him. And I met him. I finally met him.
At Virginia, that was the science and technology thing.
Yeah, because he was the head of that. And that was the thing that made Virginia Tech a very kind of attractive place from my standpoint, was that this was a very strong science technology studies place, which was run by philosophers, which is unusual, right? So I went there. But the thing about him, he was a guy who was very, even though he was very critical of David Bloor and all these people, he took them seriously, you know? So if you read his book, like Progress and Its Problems, he's got a whole chapter on the sociological stuff where he mm-hmm. goes through the arguments and he, you know, he says what he agrees with and doesn't agree with. And so I think that was kind of the feeling of the time. There was a sense in which these were people worth dealing with, mm-hmm. you know? Because there was like a common ground going on. I mean, what you see today is is quite different, because of course there are philosophers who go into science technology studies, but very often what they end up doing is they leave the philosophy behind. You know, they kind of go native. They sort of, if we talk about this in more detail, I can give you some examples of people who, in a sense, were trained as as it were, proper philosophers of science, but you'd never guess it from what they've written, given that they write in the STS vein. And see, I have never thought you had to make this kind of trade-off, and so in this respect, I'm kind of part of the old school that way.
So was Atrestes at philosophers and also sociologists in that vein. And at the time, did you feel that you had any allies, people that were on your side?
Well, you see, one of the things that I had done, and this was deliberate, was that the year before I published Social Epistemology, I started the journal Social Epistemology. That wasn't by accident. That was precisely to build a platform, right, where people could kind of come on board, and then you could start organizing in some way. And that was really very useful for me to motivate the book project. And that was kind of deliberate, because, you know, even though I was a young person back then, I wasn't completely stupid about the way in which academic politics worked, and it wasn't going to be very easy to get something like this off the ground unless you had some kind of platform. And so by having a journal called Social Epistemology, and by the way, this name, I mean, I you know, if you've heard, the name itself, I mean, the name itself goes back to the 1960s, but in terms of my use of the name, it was because I was invited to contribute to special issue of the journal Synthèse on social epistemology, which was put together by Fred Schmidt, one of the analytic philosophers.
Ah, it's the first two chapters of the book.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The article that I wrote got into that, now, when I saw... Now, I was invited to... Now, this is the interesting thing. I was invited to contribute to that special issue when I was a graduate student, like in 1983, okay, 24 years old, because I had written a review essay in the journal Erkenntnis, right, the old logical positivist journal, which was the first review of any of the sociology of science stuff that journal had ever covered. And this guy Schmidt was very impressed, you know, that I was, because I was actually trying to show the philosophical relevance of all this, blah, blah, blah. By the way, this had nothing to do with my PhD. This was something I was just doing in my spare time. And so he invited me to this. And when he sent me the specification of the range of topics that he wanted to cover under social epistemology, I immediately look at this and say, you know, this is pretty interesting. You know, and I'm interested in all this stuff. And, you know, because part of what he was bringing out was also the... You know, that when we talk about scientific reasoning, we can't just be talking about formal logic. We got to be talking about argumentation. And you see, I have a background in rhetoric. I'd studied rhetoric. So all of this made a lot of sense to me. And so I said, you know, we need a journal for this. This is my view. And so I kind of worked on that. And that was kind of how I appropriated the term. I mean, I'm pretty sure Schmidt himself was really always thinking along much more focused analytic lines, and if you look at all the other people who contribute to that special issue of Synthèse, right, it's usual analytic suspects, basically. I'm the only sort of strange character in that list. But you know, that was where I got the idea, was from that.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the other side, were there adversaries that you had in mind when you wrote that book? I mean, there's the... there's this camp of analytic philosophers and epistemologists, and then...
Well, I mean, look, here's the thing. Going into it, what I had already written some articles on, again, on my spare time, not part of my PhD, I was very much taken at the time by this thing that Richard Rorty was on about, like, you know, we need a rapprochement between analytic and continental philosophy. And that we need to somehow find a way of bridging the gaps and all the rest of it. And I guess I kind of saw the divide that separated the philosophers from the sociologists of science kind of in the same way. I mean, at least, I mean, Rorty was kind of always sort of in the background. I mean, in fact, I think, as I recall, Thomas Nichols, who wrote the foreword to the book Social Epistemology, I think makes some reference to Rorty pretty early on.
Yeah, he does.
And I think that's a fair... That's certainly in the air, right? That's kind of in the air, that we need some kind of rapprochement. And so I didn't write this book to be... I mean, whereas some of my books, I guess, would be much more explicitly polemical, you know, and having clear targets and all the rest. This book was actually meant to be kind of a synthesizing things that otherwise would not be seen as relevant to each other or having, you know, subject to common cause or something like that. So I think that's more the spirit in which social epistemology. So it was written very much as like a kind of an agenda that we could all join in on. You know, it's kind of more like that.
And when it came out, I mean, I've read the reviews that came out around that time, but how do you think it was perceived and by whom?
Oh, I think it was. I think people found it interesting. They thought it was different. I think, if I had a general view, I think was that, you know, this is a guy to watch out for. I think that was pretty much, you know, and then leave it open what to beyond that, you know. So I did think it, I mean, I think it's pretty clear. It was easy for me to get my next book contract, you know, these kind of things. It was, It definitely helped my career. Let's put it that way. But I think I didn't have any. I never had any illusions that it was going to somehow overturn the field. In the sense that those old guys, who, you know, they're still around. I mean, all these people who, you know, I'm supposedly trying to supersede, they're not gone, okay? In fact, it is really striking how little things have changed. I mean, to me, things have not changed nearly as much as I would have hoped. Mm-hmm. It raises a very interesting point, because at the moment, Synthèse is putting together a special issue on, which I guess might be called something like Whatever Happened to Social Epistemology, something like, you know, an update. And I'm writing something for this. And one of the things that the guy who's editing this is always urging me, he said, you know, you ought to be dealing with these analytic guys more. You know, you ought to be kind of, you know, dealing with them more on their own turf and all this. And my view about this is, these guys are never going to change. I mean, there's a sense in which analytic philosophy, while it is great as a kind of way of developing tools to sharpen your mind, and I don't regret having spent a lot of time studying it. I always find it incredibly useful. I have no regrets. What I do find problematic, though, people who just sort of see it as an end in itself, and they end up working over the same examples and the same trivial cases, and you know, and they just end up going around in circles talking to each other, and they have no, and for a field that's supposed to be about the foundations of knowledge, they have absolutely no impact on ordinary knowledge production. It is a self-contained field. You know, and it seems to me that's what damns it. Okay, I mean, I have nothing against being technical or anything like that. That's fine as long as it has some kind of import. But if you end up you're supposed to be talking about the nature of knowledge, and you end up finding out that you're only talking to each other, you know, then there's a problem. It seems to me.
Yeah,
and I don't, and to be honest with you, I don't see what it is I can do to solve this problem. You know, because telling these people that they should be doing something else is kind of what I've been saying for the last 30 years. They don't listen. So, you know, I got better things to do with my time. I mean, I don't know. I mean, so it is that aspect of it is a little frustrating, but I think one has to just kind of live with it. You know, and always try to be positive. Do one's own thing.
Yeah. Okay. If you have a few minutes.
Sure.
Could you maybe talk a little bit about the references in the first chapter of your book? Just who they are, and just the ones you find important, and I highlighted them.
Why don't you, start naming
them. Okay, so the first one's Larry Lawden.
Yeah, I said a little bit about him already.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want me to say any more? I mean, he was a guy, in terms of his educational background, it was very characteristic of that period. of these historical... So first of all, he's a guy with a background originally in physics, which mm-hmm. was very common to all those historical philosophers of science that typically came from physics or mathematics. And then he spent some time studying in Britain and in America. He was the one who founded the History and Philosophy of Science program at Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Which is the main one in the U.S. It's the one I did my PhD in. He was someone who basically took seriously the kind of Kuhn view that if we're going to talk about the history of science, we can't be just talking about individual discoveries or individual people, but we have to think about some kind of social unit. Loudon liked to talk about traditions, but you know, the point is you need some kind of macro social entity. Mm. And then the difference between him and Kuhn was that Loudon believed that you could talk about progress in a more robust way than Kuhn did. You could talk about increased problem-solving effectiveness, basically. That was kind of what he was going after. And that was actually a very popular way back then of talking about, you know, what science does. It solves problems. And then the question was, where do the problems come from? Does science set its own problems, or do the problems come from the outside? That was an issue. But problem-solving effectiveness was one of the things that Loudon was very big on. And he was an influential figure until the 1980s, early 1980s, I would say.
Okay, and you knew him?
He came to my first talk in 1982, but I didn't really have a chance to talk to him very much until 1989. When he ran a summer school for the National Endowment for the Humanities on naturalized epistemology. Mm-hmm. And this was when he was already in the University of Hawaii, because you know this is where he retired, to Hawaii. He was fine. I mean, one thing about this guy, one reason why he's not quite as important as he used to be is he didn't suffer fools gladly, this guy. Mm. He's a very smart guy, but very impatient person. Okay. Yeah, I think that really hurt him. And also, after a while, he withdrew, because he got some very nasty reviews and things like this. One thing about academia, it's very funny. I mean, you got to have thick skin, you know. You got to have thick skin. And even though he was, he at one level he seemed a very competent person, he eventually just kind of retreated. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, I've read his name a couple of times.
Yeah, he was a big deal. He was a big deal.
Yeah. Mm. Another one you quote a few times is Hacking. I mean,
Ian Hacking.
Yeah, he's almost another canonical figure.
Yeah, yeah. One thing I would say about Hacking, again, when I was writing about it, because Hacking's career, you know, has gone through many phases. So when I first saw him, I saw him at Cambridge, because he was a fellow of Peterhouse College, and I saw him give a paper to the Moral Sciences Club when I was a student there. But this must have been like 1980, and the stuff of his that I really like is actually not the stuff that people are paying attention to these days.
Yeah, it's the early stuff.
That's right, exactly. The Emergence of Probability and Why Does Language Matter to Philosophy and those works. Because I think what happened... Because those works are very interesting because he really showed the way in which Foucault could act as a kind of critical foil to a lot of the assumptions that people who were... you know, writing about the history of science and history of mathematics we're doing. But I think the problem is I don't buy a lot of his ontological stuff. I mean, we're, you know, like the way he divides up the different kinds, the social kinds and the natural kinds, and, you know, you know, all this kind of stuff he's done in his later work, which has made him very popular with science and technology studies people. I'm not quite on board with that stuff. I mean, I've reviewed his books and things like this, but I generally think that he's kind of I don't think this stuff is quite as bold as the earlier stuff was. I mean, there is, you know, It's funny. One of the consequences of people who come to get accepted by a community is that it can maybe dull their critical sensibility. They start becoming captive to their fans, or something like that. And so I kind of lost my fascination with him.
Yeah.
But he was very important back then.
Yeah. Yeah, you quote him quite a lot.
Yeah.
Another person that you don't... Well, yeah, you do write about him, but Feierabend...
Yeah, so Paul Feierabend was a student of Popper's, and a student of Wittgenstein as well. And he is the guy who... you know this book of his, Against Method, right? Which was the most, very radical extension of the Popper thesis. I mean, the thing about Karl Popper that people often don't realize is that that Popper was not, while Popper is considered a kind of methodologist in a way, his methodology, such as it is purely negative, right? It's about falsifying. Right? So in other words, there's no way of proving anything. But there are ways of, showing things aren't right. And Feierabend, in a way, took that idea to its largest conclusion, in the sense that if you really take the Popper point seriously, then everything that we normally consider to be true is just a kind of falsehood waiting to happen. Right, we just haven't figured out what's wrong with it yet, but we will eventually. And so this, then, if you're a scientist, forces you into the position of always being against the status quo. Right, if you're really scientific, you cannot take anything for granted. Anything that's taken for granted is exactly the kind of thing you ought to be challenging. Okay. Now, the thing, so then he writes this book against Method, which is kind of about this, and the focal point is Galileo, right? The trial of Galileo and his particular interpretation of it. Because the thing about Galileo, of course, is Galileo is challenging taken-for-granted views all the time. So he's very Popperian, in a sense, he's very Popperian Galileo. But, of course, and this is the thing that, this is the twist, Galileo doesn't know what he's talking about. I mean, this is according to Feierabend, right? Since Galileo is making stuff up. Galileo, he didn't know how his telescope worked. He didn't have the optics for it. He made up the experiments that he did with the projectiles and the inclined planes and all this kind of stuff. And his interrogators in the Vatican called him out on it. And he just bullshitted his way through, and they saw through it, okay? But the thing that's interesting is that Galileo was actually challenging the church properly in the sense that he was raising valid objections. It's just he wasn't in a position to verify anything, okay? It would only happen later, right? After his... and so Feierabend's view is, look, if you look at this whole history, right, what does this say about Method? Well, it basically tells you Method is not the thing you need to focus on, because it isn't any of this whole episode is not about Method at all, right? It's about a kind of critical sensibility being kind of advanced, right? Which impresses a lot of people, doesn't convince everyone, but impresses a lot of people, which then motivates people to actually come up with the goods, which then eventually validates what he was saying.
Yeah.
You see, and that does not conform to a kind of standard model of what the scientific method is. You see, and it shows, of course, things that are interesting, like, the Galileo episode is an episode in rhetoric, right? There's all this negotiating going on, this kind of bluffmanship going on, and that's very integral to what people end up taking to be credible or not credible. So I mean, so Feierabend, in a way, took the kind of Popperian... premise and kind of gave it made it a much more living thing, because Popper, at the end of the day, his manner was I don't know if you've ever seen Popper. I mean, I actually saw Popper shortly before he died, Popper was like, he in a certain respect, he was just like the positivist in terms of his manner, in terms of the formality, all this kind of stuff.
He was boring, and Feierabend was not, I guess.
exactly. But the point is that Feierabend is basically playing off of the idea. He's playing off the Popperian idea.
But I mean, in your book, you argue against this kind of anarchism.
Yeah.
In a way.
I do, that's right, I do. I mean, because I think... see, this is where I do disagree with Feyerabend, because sometimes people think my views are quite similar to his. I mean, I think you need to have a kind of institutionalized critical rationality, right? In other words, it doesn't happen naturally. You can't just depend on Galileos to come along and do this stuff. I mean, in a sense, Feyerabend is a bit like a libertarian, you know, who thinks, well, you know, geniuses will just happen. People will just be critical. You know, if you just allow them, if you just give them the freedom, they'll do it. I'm not so sure about that. I think the pressure to conform is very strong, and that we actually need to make science open and critical. This is something that requires explicit institutionalization and legislation. It does not happen naturally. Otherwise, you know, science wouldn't be such a special thing in culture. Everybody would be a scientist criticizing things all the time, and you know, but that doesn't happen.
Yeah. There's another one I don't know. That's Krieger. Do you know?
Which, can you show me?
Krieger 80.
John Krieger. He's not such a big deal. I mean, he was just a. He's more of a. He's a historian who actually wrote about the history of progress and things like that. Who was in a sense kind of on the Loudon tip, but he's a kind of minor figure. He's just, okay. Yeah, yeah.
And there's three more people
sure.
that I'm not really familiar with that you group with the new wave people, and that's Gilbert and Mulcahy.
Yeah, Gilbert and Mulcahy. Sure, Nigel Gilbert, Michael Mulcahy. Michael Mulcahy was the in Britain. Michael Mulcahy was the guy who introduced the ethnomethodology method to science and technology studies. So he was the person who Steve Woolgar did his PhD with.
Oh.
Okay, York University?
Yeah,
York
University. Yeah.
Okay. So Mulcahy was a guy who trained in... He's British, but he trained in Los Angeles with Aaron Sicarel, one of the early ethnomethodologists. Right, and so he brought that back to Britain... And he applied it to the sciences. And Gilbert was another one who... Nigel Gilbert, actually, in subsequent years, actually got very much involved with social simulations, computer... Yeah, he kind of moved in a totally different direction. And is now the pro-vice chancellor at Surrey University.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But Mulcahy was the one who brought ethnomethodology to Britain, you might say.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hmm. And Collins?
Which Collins? Harry Collins? You can show me. I can.
Because there are two.
Yeah, it's Harry. Harry Collins. Okay. Well, Harry Collins is kind of a big deal. He was a guy who studied with Barnes and Bloor at Edinburgh, but he did ethnographic work, which they didn't do up there. So he was the one who kind of applied a kind of Edinburgh School perspective, but through ethnography. But his ethnography is different from Latour and Woolgar because it isn't so demystifying. It's a little different. I'll give you an idea. What he likes to study is stuff like tacit knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so tacit knowledge, I mean, this was one of the things that was science studies got very important for. They're very much influenced by Michael Polanyi. Okay, Michael Polanyi was saying that, you know, you cannot reduce science to method or formulas of how to do things, a recipe book or something like that. But rather, the way you learn about how to do science is simply by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of craft element that really is kind of like the knowledge is in your hands. It's not in your, you know, you can't speak it, right? Yeah. And so Harry Collins basically... studied this, and the way what he focused on was the problems of replicating experiments, right? Because when you read a scientific article, right, it tells you how an experiment was done. But yeah, and it looks like you're being told how the experiment was done, but now you try to do the experiment.
Mm.
You realize very quickly you don't have enough information.
Mm.
That there's some things that not, you know, what do I do next? You know, there's some missing links. And so what you often have to do, and this is one of the things he studied, was you have to call the guy up, right? You have to say, hey, look, you know, I'm trying to reproduce your results for my own research, but I can't get this thing to work. What am I doing wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And so he studied the sorts of things that turn out to be missing.
Mm-hmm.
And the sorts of things that are, in fact, quite difficult to articulate, and that sometimes you even have to just go to the other guy's lab and do it for him. Right? And, you know, you can't, like, tell him over the phone yeah. what to do. You have to kind of go there. And so his point was that, Collins's point was basically, rarely, if ever, are experiments reproduced in any strict sense.
Hmm.
That there's always some variation that you can never quite, because the other person trying to reproduce the experiment is not starting from exactly the same conditions hmm. as you're starting from. And so you have to improvise various aspects in order to get the thing to come out right.
Hmm.
And so what you end up doing, in effect, very often, is you may be reproducing an effect, but you're not necessarily reproducing the means by which the effect mm-hmm. was brought about. This is kind of his point.
Hi.
Yeah. And in recent years, and right now, he's known as, he's very big on studying expertise.
Uh-huh.
And in particular, it's an interesting question. How much do you need to know of a subject area in order to be able to be taken seriously as someone who could affect that subject area? Right, so I could start talking to you about quantum physics, but no quantum physicist is going to change his experiment as a result of anything I say.
Mm.
You know, but then there might be a certain kind of knowledge you could have, even if you're not a PhD in quantum mechanics, which if you told a scientist, they'd say, yeah, you know, you might have something there.
So it's about epistemic positions.
Yeah. And so Collins studies this sort of empirically, right, without assuming that there's a natural answer.
Yeah. All right, last one.
Sure.
From this Chapin, we just talked about him.
Yeah. So Steve Chapin is a historian. Again, he was a person from the Edinburgh School. And he really hit the stage in 1985 with a book with Simon Schaffer called Leviathan and the Air Pump. And this is a book about, it's probably the most important book in the history of science that is done from an STS viewpoint. So this book is basically about how Thomas Hobbes, hence the Leviathan, was excluded from membership in the Royal Society in the 17th century. And the issue, and this is seen as a kind of an example of boundary work, right? Mm. Namely, a moment, according to them, the moment at which a clear distinction between science and philosophy was drawn.
Mm.
So Thomas Hobbes is basically arguing that the air pump, which is this thing that Robert Boyle invented to demonstrate the existence of a vacuum, Hobbes said that in principle vacuums do not exist in nature. You can do all the experiments you want.
Hmm.
I can explain them away. Right? The world is full of invisible matter, right? Hmm. This is what Hobbes believes. Well, so you get a sense of what the arguments are and everything and where the people are coming from and all the rest of it. And the thing that comes up over the course of this controversy is that there is a question about who is a reliable witness and who is a credible judge of an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it a guy like Hobbes who's a kind of philosopher and doesn't mess around with stuff and just observes things? Or is it a guy like Boyle who actually knows how to do an experiment?
Mm.
And see, there the issue, it's kind of like the social construction of competence, right, comes about. And at the end of it, what happens is guys like Hobbes, you know, who at the time of the debate was seen as being kind of on the same level as Boyle, both equally competent. By the end of the debate, Hobbes is this kind of ignorant philosopher, and Boyle is like this master scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And this then sets the precedent for the distinction between these two kinds of fields. And so one of the things that you learn is that, the Royal Society is very keen on having a way of ending disputes.
Mm-hmm.
Because if disputes do not end, especially if they're over these deep matters about metaphysics and so forth, then you could have the kinds of problems that had led to the English Civil War, which was just over, right, in the period after when the Royal Society gets established. And so it became very important that they have ways of resolving disputes peacefully, and this meant excluding people who weren't willing to take no for an answer. And Hobbes was just questioning. He just kept questioning all the time.
Yeah.
And so that book was very iconic, and it kind of got people to see in a very clear way what the social construction of knowledge means, and the way in which power is kind of implicated in it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay, so that's it?
For me, that could be it.
Okay.
Just turn this. I have a lot more questions, obviously, but